The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt on a grim day. I've had more time than most to think about this as the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I were driving yesterday quite a lot, and we had a chance to discuss the horrific shooting of 3 9-year-olds and 3 teachers and school administrators in Nashville. I'll begin with the Washington Post story. 3 9-year-olds, 3 adults. They all spent their Monday morning at the Covenant High School in Nashville before a shooter opened fire at a private school that serves about 200 students from pre-kindergarten to 6th grade. Nashville police identified the 6 victims in the shooting as Evelyn Dykhouse, Haley Scruggs, and William Kinney, all 9 years old. Catherine Kuntz, 60, Cynthia Peake, 61, Mike Hill, 61. The children were students at the school and adults were staff members, police said during an afternoon press conference. Kuntz is listed on Covenant's website as head of school. Peake was a substitute teacher. Hill was a custodian. That is the facts. I will not use a shooter's name. I just won't. The shooter is a woman who identifies as a man. It is unclear if she is a trans man, as has been reported. I don't know if she's had any transition medication or if she was on. We don't know anything. She wrote a manifesto. It has not been released. I'm astonished by that. I would read the manifesto to you without naming her. But the Telegraph of Great Britain is the only place I find a headline like this. Nashville school shooting, trans killers, gender identity investigated as a possible motive. And that is true. We don't know whether or not it is. We don't know what her mental illness was, but we know it's profound. Now, yesterday I was telling you about a quote that I found particularly arresting from John Steinbeck's East of Eden. I'm going to repeat it again today. I finished listening to John Steinbeck's East of Eden recently, and I just was struck by how profound it is. It's a book about good and evil. It's about Cain and Abel. It's about the never-ending story of good versus evil. And in it, Steinbeck writes some haunting paragraphs. A child may ask, what is the world's story about? And a grown man or woman may wonder, what way will the world go? How does it end? And while we're at it, what's the story about? I believe that there is one story in the world, Steinbeck writes, and only one that has frightened and inspired us so that we live in a pearl-white serial of continuing thought and wonder. Humans are caught in their lives, in their thoughts, in their hungers and ambitions, in their avarice and cruelty, and in their kindness and generosity too, in a net of good and evil. I think this is the one story we have, and that it occurs on all levels of feelings and intelligence. Virtue and vice were warp and woof of our first consciousness, and they will be the fabric of our last. And this despite any changes we impose on field and river, on mountain, on economy and manners. There is no other story. A man, after he has brushed off the dust on the chips of his life, will have left only the hard, clean questions. Was it good or was it evil? Have I done well or ill? End of East of Eden quote. This is an evil act. It's pure evil. We don't know why the person did it. Everybody has said the same thing that they have said previously about guns. I don't intend to go there. I just wonder if you think we can find our way back. 1-800-520-1234. I have prayed for the children and for their siblings and for their parents and for their grandparents and for every member of the school. I prayed for the staff. I prayed for the killer and her family. The killer is obviously unbalanced, as they all are. Now, many people want to talk about gun control today, to which I always respond the same way after a mass shooting. And then we have a couple of these stories every year, a couple of these dreadful mornings every year. I always say the same thing. What would you do? What Governor Glenn Youngkin is doing is pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into mental health treatment and open resources for people who are suffering and know and have self-diagnosed, or their parents or family or friends know, that they've fallen into the darkness. And the answer here is not a ban on AR-15s. I mean, that shed pistols as well as AR-15s. That's not it. The answer is, what do we do to stop our young people from careening? And it's not a large percentage of people who are trapped in psychotic killing madness. It's significant enough. But I'll play for you the police captain yesterday, Police Chief John Drake, identifying the shooter. He will use her name. I will not. Cut number six.
Thank you, Mayor Cooper. Again, thank you all for being here. Just an update from today's press conference. We've identified the shooter as Audrey Hale, a 28-year-old female that lived in the Nashville area. We have investigations ongoing now at the residence on Brightwood Avenue. And we have made contact with the father that lived at that residence and are putting together more information. We've also determined there were maps drawn of the school in detail of surveillance, entry points, etc. We know and believe that entry was gained through shooting through one of the doors is how they actually got into the school. I want to take the time to at least say, and I won't say the victims' names, I'll let Don say that, but out of the six victims, three adults, three of those were children. Two of them were age nine. One was eight, about to be nine. All the families have been contacted. The victims' families have been contacted as well. My thoughts and prayers go out to the family. When we send our kids to school or to any place of safety, we expect them to live, learn, have fun, and come back from that day's experience. We don't anticipate things like this. And I want to say thank you to our partners, to Chief Swan, to Glenn Funk, to our mayor for his support, to our federal partners. But also I want to say thank you to our first responders who got there and immediately went in and addressed the threat of someone that had multiple rounds of ammunition, prepared for a confrontation with law enforcement, prepared to do more harm than was actually done, and we were able to stop the threat, and unfortunately, six victims.
All right, how does someone not see that? How does someone not know what she is planning to do? Tennessee, I believe, has a red flag law, and that is the first line of defense for every school in America. The second line is having a school resource officer near the front door or near any side door. Side door should just simply not be available as a point of entry. And we may have the video of her shooting her way into Covenant Presbyterian School. And she blew open the front door. If there's an SRO standing there armed, that's the end of it. I have no patience for people who will not admit the obvious. We're not going to repeal the Second Amendment. People can try. People can introduce that. A ban on AR-15s will not stop this. What will stop this is intervention in troubled people's lives and mandatory commitment and observant friends, family, and parents. And I don't know how many people know this killer, but they're the ones burdened this morning with guilt. Nobody else. Nobody else. The killer and those who knew and could have said something and didn't, and that might be a zero set. Maybe she was completely hidden in that. But I'm going to let anyone call who wants to call and talk about it, but do not indulge in hate against people who are transitioning. I never do. Welcome back, America. David Drucker is with The Dispatch. You can follow him on Twitter at David M. Drucker. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. Good morning.
You have small children, so obviously, as every parent and every grandparent, a gut punch like Nashville hits you. What did you make of the responses in D.C. yesterday? Does anyone just sit down and wait for a while before they jump to their agenda?
No. No. Nobody in D.C. sits down and waits. And, you know, apparently or unfortunately, we have social media platforms that give us immediate catharsis and a way to publish every thought bubble, every inane thought bubble that comes into our head. And that's just in a sense, that's always been politics. There have always just been logistical hurdles that have gotten in the way of what people want to say and how fast they want to say it. And probably by default gave them a chance to reconsider or examine new facts that didn't, you know, whether they fit their preconceived analysis of some event or not. But it's just waiting is just not something you see out of Washington anymore, at least when it comes to speaking. When it comes to doing, well, there can be a long wait for that.
Well, I don't know what D.C. can do about this, but I do know every single time this happens, every single time, people are out of the gates with their agenda to impose their narrative upon a tragedy without reference to anyone involved or to the circumstance and without knowledge. I mean, literally every time, David.
Yeah, Hugh, that's just the way it is. I mean, it's a great case for an editor or at least a member of your staff telling you to stop and at least examine the facts so that if you want to make a connection, it can make some sense and do you some good just selfishly. But look, people don't wait. But I see a lot of tweets, let's say, and they come from all over the country. It's not just Washington. Everybody is in a rush to fit an event into a narrative to confirm priors. And look, obviously there are certain facts that are going to confirm certain priors somewhere. They're going to fit into a preconceived notion of events somewhere. But people do not like to wait. When these things happen, and by the way, I count just natural disasters. I count things that are bad, but not a, you know, as you said, like not a gut punch like this, not so, they're so tragic. I just do less when it comes to saying anything on social media or retweeting anything.
Oh,
I
you
need
and
to
me
see
both.
What the facts are before you I start to before I start to add any voice to it.
I just retreat because if I've learned anything, it's not only that first reports are always wrong, but it's also that whatever you say now, you have no idea what you're talking about or commenting on. And so I've had a good 18 hours to think and mull before I go on the air. So some people don't have the advantage of that. And television hates to just stick to the facts, right? They just hate that. They want to advance the narrative.
Right.
And cable's got to get back to the debate. The question becomes, the president went out and immediately called for an AR-15 ban. I think that was unwise. I don't think it served the people of Tennessee or of Nashville or the victims of their families well. But did it surprise you that he did that?
Well, no, of course not. Look, this is something Democrats in general believe would make people safer. And they've been calling for these sorts of firearms bans for quite a long time. Something which was very surprising to me politically got done last year on a bipartisan basis that dealt with more gun regulations. But the AR-15 ban is something Democrats have in particular been calling for. And they think there should be an AR-15 ban, whether or not these sorts of events happen. They think that they would prevent these sorts of events from happening, but they just don't think AR-15s belong on the streets. So not surprised at all. It's what Democrats want. And look, Joe Biden has been at the forefront of gun regulations for many years. And so I'm not surprised at all.
Oh, yeah, a decent interval would have been nice. By the way, for those watching on the Salem News Channel, the lower third on David Drucker says, Hugh Hewitt, we have a ghost in the machine. So don't be upset with David. That's not David. That's me. David Drucker, in terms of I want to go to one story earlier. What was the reaction to President Trump's rally in Waco?
Well, look, I think President Trump with his rallies delivers pretty consistently. And if you like it, you like it. And if you don't, you don't. Right. And so Republicans are sorting through their nomination process, which for now seems to be a Trump or Ron DeSantis sort of a contest, even though the governor of Florida isn't actually a candidate yet. And, you know, the general argument that you hear from Republicans is that what Trump does works and can work. And that's the horse you should go with. And then you have a lot of Republicans that are either exhausted by the whole thing and tired of it or say, listen, I kind of like the guy personally, and the rallies are great, but he can't win a general election. He can't win swing voters and independents. So we have to move on for the sake of being pragmatic and actually winning. And I don't really think his rallies are going to generate much more discussion than that, because they're not new anymore. There's still something that nobody else does, maybe that nobody else can do, but they're not new, and they don't have that same feel and that same impact on the electorate as they did 8 years ago.
And you know, his feedback loop is not telling him, talk about the future. When I have him on next time, I'm going to ask him about that. Why aren't you talking about the future as opposed to the past? David M. Drucker on Twitter with The Dispatch, senior political correspondent for The Dispatch. Thank you, David. I'll be right back. Hour number two on A Grim Morning America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us. I'm joined by Byron York. You see him on Fox News. Of course, he is also the senior political correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Good morning, Byron.
Hi, Hugh.
This is one of those grim mornings, and I've had to do this way too many times in 23 years of this radio show, but I am increasingly frustrated by the automatic responses that follow from the imposition of agenda on disaster and tragedy. Do you see the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you saw it in President Biden's remarks. Did you refer to them as weird? I thought they were very
I'm about to play them. I've been waiting for them to load. I didn't want to play clips. They were odd.
Look at the transcript on the White House web page, and the president, you know, always engages in the same sort of pleasantries when he walks into a room. He mentions a couple of people he knows. He tells you something, in this case, that he has a lot of ice cream upstairs, and then he tells you it's not a joke. And then he sees somebody he worked with and goes on about being in the Senate for 1,000 years, and that's kind of it. And he did the whole shtick yesterday, which just seemed odd because people were upset about what happened. And then he did get around to an assault weapons ban. But, you know, one thing I didn't hear listening to your program, you know, in June of last year, 2022, President Biden signed something called the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act into law, which was viewed as the biggest, most significant gun safety legislation in years and years. It was done after Uvalde, I think. And, of course, it didn't have any effect at all.
And I think Tennessee has a red flag law, and I don't think it worked. And so it didn't work again. It usually doesn't work, but it might stop some. We don't know. You can't prove a negative, right? It didn't happen. But, Byron, I don't understand. But from the left and the right, I cut off a call this morning who wanted to argue we shouldn't be sending weapons to Ukraine while we're not protecting our schools. That's hobby horsing an issue. And I don't think Americans buy this anymore. I think they just turn off people who impose agendas on stories.
Yeah, and I think that basically your position is you would like to just see police at every school, right?
Yeah, and my position is the Second Amendment isn't going anywhere. By all means, introduce an amendment if you want to repeal it, but it's not going anywhere. We know what it meant, and that means there are a lot of guns in America, more than 300 million. We're not going to get. I'm a realist about everything, and I don't have any time for constitutional amendments.
Yeah, I think that the idea of a police at every school is probably the best single idea. You saw the police in Nashville release video of this shooter actually shooting through locked glass, heavy glass doors. And of course the gun made quick work of all of the glass, and she just walked in, crawled in through the openings that were created. So locking something up is not doing the trick. And it appears, I know you were talking about the response time of the national police tweeted out very quickly yesterday that their officers had immediately gone to the sound of the gunfire and then killed the shooter. And so if there's any response time issue, I guess we have to know how long between the moment the police arrived on the scene and actually killed the shooter. But it appears to be pretty quick.
I think it's 13 minutes from call. I think it's 30. And I also think the school must have had some protocols, because while terrible and gut-wrenching that 3 9-year-olds and 3 adults are killed, it's much less than the 250 to 300 people on the campus.
Yeah. And as far as the police response is concerned, I mean, this is this was great compared to the horror that happened in Uvalde. And it also showed that, you know, two trained police officers could take down this shooter, and nobody, the police were not injured.
Yeah. And so I do think that will be the takeaway from this, is that police have to do what they did here, which that has been the protocol since Columbine, except in Uvalde, which is enter immediately and engage the killer. Now, Byron, in terms of impact on American politics, I don't think it will have much, because we don't have any options beyond what we've just discussed.
It never really does. I do think that this one is going to be slightly unique, in the sense that there's all this confusion yesterday about the gender of the shooter, who is a woman who may or may not have identified as a man in recent weeks, months, or years. This manifesto would probably tell us a lot more. But if the motive for the shooting involves some sort of trans issues, that's just going to cause a lot of the news media and Democratic politicians to just be very uncomfortable and kind of twist themselves into pretzels to try to not focus on those issues if they are, in fact, the motive for this crime.
You know, so, the only place I saw it mentioned was in the British papers. It's just the Telegraph. Nashville school shooting, trans killer, gender identity investigated as possible motive. Post, Times, Wall Street Journal, none of that. And so
the police actually said it. I mean,
yes.
The police came out and said it.
What inference do you draw from that, the way it's been covered? Because I honestly couldn't figure out if it was a biological male or biological female for a good hour and a half because of...
Yeah, I was totally confused about that myself. I said, was this person born a male or a female? And apparently she was born a female and then had identified as of late as a male. So it was difficult to find, in part because of our Orwellian language that refers to a trans woman. And you think, well, a trans woman means a biological male.
Right.
So
and the other thing.
It's difficult to understand.
Very difficult, and the name changes, but it doesn't mean that she was, quote, transitioning. It could just mean sympathy for the trans community and the LGBTQ plus agenda. But that doesn't mean that has anything to do with her actions either. Who knows? This is the interesting thing. Somebody knows her. People, she's on the web, she's a graphic designer. We haven't seen much about her yet. I don't want to use her name, but we haven't. I think the news media is deathly afraid of offending people.
I'm surprised that we have not seen the manifesto. I'm always in favor of more public information, so I think we should see the manifesto. And I'm just wondering, the usual suspects of internet sleuths out there don't seem to have unearthed it. I mean, it could be the rarest of things, a document that's not posted on the internet. I don't know.
Well, that won't not fly, because there will be liability suits and it will eventually come out. Now, John Cooper is the mayor of Nashville. He's a very smart guy, old friend of mine. I went to school with him, and he's Democrat, very, very smart center left Democrat. And he may just have cautioned the police department against preemptive act. There's also an investigatory side, which is, if people are named in this, you've got to find out whether or not they had anything to do with the planning. And so there may be a legit investigatory reason not to release it, but by tomorrow it's got to be released.
Yeah, I would absolutely think so. And not that it's going to make a huge amount of difference in the policy debate that occurs afterwards, which is going to be, this is how we started this conversation, it's going to be a repeat of the assault weapons ban policy debate we've had a million times. And, you know, if this happens again, then we'll actually have again.
So the gay club that was the LGBTQ club that was shot up in Colorado, we come to discover it's not an ideological purpose. And I don't want to ascribe ideology to anyone. Often shootings are just crazy people, like Gabby Giffords was shot by a schizophrenic break victim. You just can't tell, but I just can't imagine the American public rewarding anyone who politicized. I think the president politicized this out of the gate. I really do, Byron.
Well, of course he did. But, you know, this is this has happened. The instant politicization has been happening for a while, because if you look at comments from people on the left, either Democratic politicians or activists, a long time ago, they began to start mocking Republicans, the thoughts and prayers gambit. You know, the Republican senator or representative says, "Oh, my thoughts and prayers are with the people of blank after this terrible shooting." And so you began to see a lot of comments, you know, the hell with your thoughts and prayers. We need action. Basically, they've just kind of skipped any formalities of expressing.
Right. There's no touching of gloves. Let's have a debate about guns. None of that. Just make Christians feel like they are subhuman and lack feelings because they want to use it as a sop, which is, in fact, the opposite of almost every person of faith that I know. Byron York, thank you. We'll be looking for you on Fox News all day. There's one story today, and we will continue to cover it. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. Good to see you.
Earlier this morning, when I was talking to Detective Tom from Oakland about the killings in Nashville yesterday, our friend Captain Mark wrote me. He's a survivor of the Navy Yard shooting. He said, please remember to tell survivors to seek mental health care. Survivor's guilt and PTSD are real and treatable. And I have, you know, I've never asked you about this. You've served in the military during a long war, and you know how the Pentagon has changed. Do you want to amplify that a little bit?
Sure. Let's start with the first thing that Captain Mark said, which is it's real. When I went on active duty in the 1970s, otherwise known as 1.2 million years ago, in those days, it was not real. I mean, there was sort of lip service to it, but there were a number of books, a number of studies coming out. One I recommend to your readers, it's a very evocative title. It's called Achilles in Vietnam. And it fuses the Greek myths with this idea of stress in combat. It's by a man named Jonathan Shea. That was part of the beginning of understanding just how real this is. And I think, fortunately, as we got through Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and on to the wars on terror, and ultimately the big ground operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, the so-called forever wars, now there is a wide appreciation that, A, it's real. So let's draw a line under that. There's no shame in this. One of the great combat officers I know, I'll call him Captain Brian, first name, an astounding combat record, Silver Star, Afghanistan, under my command, came back and went to graduate school at the Fletcher School, the Kennedy School, brilliant, brilliant officer. He had PTSD. He wrote about it. He was very open about it. His career has done nothing but accelerate since then. So it's very real. There is treatment that's quite significant. And then third and finally, I'd say people receive it differently, it being traumatic stress. Some people can deal with it in very different ways. So the treatment has got to be creative, hand-tailored. There's no mass approach to this. It's got to be precision-guided for each individual. I think we're incredibly better at that, Hugh, than we were 40 years ago when I came on active duty.
Yeah, I knew one of the majors assigned to the Air Force Secretary during President Obama's tenure who was solely tasked with that silo. So they've developed silos to make sure that service members carry it with them. And not just service members, I mean parents, family, friends of any mass shooting. And I had a paralegal friend who was at the Vegas one, and she'd been in treatment for a lot of years. Very open about it and the right way to go about it. So I just want to emphasize. Now I want to ask you a little bit more difficult question. My friend Mel Spees, who's a two-star general, was telling me, retired like you, Marine, that the moral compass of young people has shifted significantly, and the Marine Corps has changed its point of view to shift the training in the basic school for their officers to put in what has been left out. What do you think about that?
I know the millennial generation and the follow-on generations very well. I'm sure General Mike does as well. They served under our command. So I also am a parent, as are you. I have young, relatively young children in their 30s. And I watch this generation closely. I think it's fair to say their moral compass may manifest itself in some different modalities. The way in which they express themselves may be less, shall we say, overtly patriotic than perhaps we've experienced in the past. But I would not make the mistake to say that particularly the millennials are not a powerful and potentially a hero generation for this country, Hugh. And that may be in, not in agreement with others, but again, it's based not only on big size survey, command of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these young people. It's also based on observing them. They care about others. They care about them. They are willing to serve. They may want to serve less in the military and more on the front lines of COVID, for example. But they are a hero generation. I'll close with this. You and I don't often talk politics, but I bet we could agree that the greatest threat the nation faces are the divisions in the country.
We're going to agree on this, which is, I think, a lot of our instability on the 3% on either end, because there's a bell curve in everything, and there's a 3% most mentally capable of dealing with trauma and resilience, and the least capable, that the internet and social media have made the 3% that are most vulnerable to mental illness much more vulnerable to mental illness, and that we have just got to change our approach to these people.
Completely agree in that, but I want to make a point about the center of that bell curve, because that's where millennials tend to live. And they look left and right at the political extremes in this country, and they are dismayed. And I believe that this millennial generation, above all, wants to try and bring us together as a nation, understanding there are going to be political differences. That could be an American hero generation. Let's give them a little time.
Now, I've talked to enough naval officers on active duty and retired to know you deal with a lot of young sailors, and they have the same problems that young sailors have always had. They don't know how to buy a car. As J.D. Vance said, he went down to Marine Corps, he didn't know how to buy a car, and the command sergeant major took him out and bought a car with him so he didn't spend all of his money on that. Yeah, they just don't know a lot when they go in. Does the military focus on these young people in ways other than training them to be warriors in an appropriate way, or too much or too little?
I think just about right. And in particular, you bring up buying a car. It's really a metaphor for the larger idea of financial literacy.
Yes.
How do you open a checking account? How do you manage a credit card? How do you ensure money goes in between your savings account and your checking account? How do you put money away for college? A thousand different things we could enumerate, including buying a car, which is a pretty good concrete idea you can latch on to. Today, you don't have to wait for the command master chief to say, okay, Jimmy, come on, bring your checkbook. We're going to go buy a motor scooter. Now there is actual training on Thursday afternoon from 2 to 4:30. The younger people will sit and get a class in financial literacy. That is a very good thing. And by the way, alongside that are a lot of other classes in life skills. Everything from resisting addiction to peer relationships. And no, it's not overdone. It's in fact a tiny part of the training in the big context of how to use your fire control radar to knock down an incoming jet, or how to operate your small craft in really choppy seas. That's 95%+. But should we be doing that 5%? Yes. And this is a pretty good example of it, because if you don't do the 5% well, your young sailor will fail at the 95% part in many cases.
I want to close with this. I tell people routinely that if they don't know for sure what they want to do at the end of high school, the best thing to do is to do a hitch in the military. The very best thing. And pick your service. I'm not here to say Navy, go Navy, beat Army. I'm here to say 4 years is a short period of time. Is it too long? Because to a millennial at 17, 4 years must look like, well, it is one fifth of their life. And they can't imagine it. And they always look back and say, it's the best years of my life when they've been in it. But what do you think about taking the message out that this is a good time to maybe go serve your country, serve yourself, and then do your program?
100% agreement. And I often say to young college graduates, and this would apply to young high school graduates as well. I'll say to a young college graduate, hey, have you thought about military service? There, in my view, and again, we're all victims of our own experience, right? Our survivor bias. But I always say, what could be better than spending the years from 21 to 26, 25, banging around on a destroyer out at sea, going to Hong Kong, going to Bahrain, going up and down the coast of South America, seeing the world, defending your country, wearing a sharp-looking uniform. Hey, nothing wrong with that. By the way, go Navy, beat Army. Going out to sea is, in fact, a lot better than digging a slit trench somewhere in the desert. But having said that, yes, you are correct. It is wonderful for all the reasons I said. And the final reason is because you'll never work with a greater group of people in your life because they're like you. They're all volunteers. They want to be part of something bigger than themselves. What's wrong with that for 4 years?
It's just something to think about today for people who are looking and being feeling grim. There are lots of great, really wonderful young people who are in the uniform. They come out of high school, they go in, or they come out of college and they go in. And it's something really to put front and center on your plate. Boy, do you learn at a rapid pace when you go into structure.
Last thought, there are a lot of ways to serve the country. Doesn't have to be the military. Think about the police force, firefighters, diplomats, CIA officers, Peace Corps, Teach for America, Volunteer for America. Spend some time serving others. There is no higher calling.
Admiral, always a pleasure to talk to you, even on a grim day. Follow him on Twitter at StavridisJ and follow me to the next segment. Thank you, Admiral. Have a good morning. Welcome back, America. One of my weekly guests is Bethany Mandel. She is the author, most recently, along with a co-author of the book Stolen Youth, and she joins me this morning. Good morning, Bethany. You look happy as always. Last week, we talked about violence that occurred at one of your book signing events. It was minor league violence compared to what happened in Tennessee yesterday. How does the mother of six react to something like this?
I mean, I mostly don't pay attention for my own mental health. I think that more people need to do that, to just sort of like tune out and focus on your kids in that moment. And also sort of wait for more information. No one in the media does that either. But it's really painful. I mean, when you first see those first pictures of, you know, the pastor's little girl, she was 9 years old, but the pictures are from when she was three or four. Man, that hits.
So I wonder what you do as a grandparent. It's not my job anymore. As a parent, yeah. I would find a moment to talk to older children, and I would try and shield younger children, because stolen youth is about innocence and you don't want them afraid of school. So how do you handle it with six? I mean, you've got an age range, obviously. You're not going to talk to the babies about it.
So, I mean, I think it depends on what their exposure is. And I think that adults, and I talk about this in Stolen Youth, we think that we need to talk about everything with kids when we might not necessarily. And so I haven't spoken to my kids about this. I didn't tell my kids about Uvalde either until weeks after the fact. And I said, you know, this happened and it's scary and it's sad. There are people in this world who are carrying with them a lot of sadness, and they take that out on the people around them. In really scary, violent ways. But I think the parents need to evaluate if they even need to talk to their kids about it, or if they need to talk to them about it right now, because parents are also still processing all of this.
Yeah. Have you ever read John Steinbeck's East of Eden, Bethany?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Okay, I just finished listening to the audio version of it by John Poe. It's very, very powerful. It's about Cain and Abel, and it's the Cain and Abel story through three generations. About where does violence come from? And Steinbeck says there's only one story. It's good versus evil. And it repeats and every story is this one story. And this story is that one story. I haven't read Stolen Youth yet. I'm overwhelmed with con law. Do you talk about that? That we've just got to anchor people in good and evil early on?
We don't. Not explicitly. I mean, I think that you're right. But I think that also we sort of have to see the full picture in situations like this. And we don't know anything really about this shooter other than, you know, name, age, you know, the basic stats, but there's a lot of brokenness in this world and it manifests in a lot of ways. And we've sort of lost our moorings as a society and as a country. And the prevalence of these shootings is a direct result of that unmooring.
You know, Justice Alito, in a famous dissent to a case that would have banned the nut jobs, Westboro Baptist Church. Westboro isn't a Christian denomination. It's a cult. And there was an attempt to punish them in civil liability for their, quote, free expression, which is torture on a family that's lost someone. And Justice Alito dissented from the defense of their right to do that, saying this is not defensible. Do you think we've gone too far in tolerating crazy speech? Just crazy, hateful speech.
No. So it's funny that you bring that up. I was literally just texting right before the show with Megan Phelps Roper, formerly of the Westboro Baptist Church. And she was talking to me about free speech because she's hosting the new J.K. Rowling podcast for the Free Press. And she is a strong believer in the importance of free speech, even when it's this vile, because even when you've gone that far on the end of sort of hate speech, and there's always a way back. And I think that people, you know, there should be a wide berth for people to be able to express themselves, even when we find it, you know, completely abhorrent.
How did she get out of the cult?
So it's really interesting. So she got into Twitter conversations with Jews, and here's my dog. She got into Twitter conversations with Jews. He's just jumping on me.
What's the name of the dog? This is going to be the favorite all-time pick. What's his name?
Truman. And he's very protective of the baby. And he hears the baby crying, and he's letting me know. It's ridiculous. He's Lassie. So she was talking to Jews about sort of, you know, what their belief system was and what was sort of, because they would hold up signs and say, you know, Jews are going to hell, God hates Jews. And she got into conversations that were very frank with Jews. And I wrote a piece that actually got me canceled in the summer of 2017 about people like the folks that talked to Megan Phelps Roper, who talk to people with humanity. And the headline of the piece is, we should start befriending neo-Nazis, and therefore I'm always called a Nazi on Twitter by lefty Twitter.
Well, you can't. If anyone sees Truman, they'll know that's not true. I want Truman every week now. This is the Bethany and Truman show now. All right? Just bring him back and go see the baby because he's worried.
Obviously.
Bethany Mandel and Truman, thank you. I want that video going viral because I love Truman. And then the old Stolen Youth has the best. I love that. It's not as good as the Korean toddler, the toddler in Korea coming into his dad's shop, but that's pretty close. Bethany, thank you. Follow her on Twitter at Bethany Shondark. Go get her book, Stolen Youth. I'll be right back. Hour three ahead on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hey, everybody, it's Dwayne Patterson of the Hugh Hewitt Show. The last time we talked, I was about 3 weeks into a 50-pound weight loss project with myphdweightloss.com. I had lost 16 pounds after 3 weeks. Today, I've lost 50 pounds in just 12 weeks and have been able to keep it off for the last 2 months. And you can, too. Myphdweightloss.com has all the information, or 864-644-1900.
Molly Hemingway is going to listen with me to the president yesterday and then talk to us about it, because yesterday the network sent out, or the White House sent out to all the networks, an alert the president would address the shooting in Nashville, and they all broke in to follow his remarks, and this is what they heard at the beginning.
My name is Joe Biden. I'm Dr. Joe Biden's husband. And I ate Jenny's ice cream, chocolate chip. I came down because I heard there was chocolate chip ice cream. By the way, I have a whole refrigerator full upstairs. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. God. Ben, how are you, pal? One of the best guys in the United States Congress, Ben Cardin. Folks, welcome to the White House. It's a delight to have you all here. And who are those good-looking kids back there? They're your kids, all four of them? Well, stand up, guys. Well, I want you to know, like you, I had two brothers, three in our family, three brothers and one sister. My sister is smarter than all of us.
Not a joke. She used to be 3 years younger than me. Now she's 23 years younger than me. Yeah. She managed every one of my campaigns for office, even back when I was in high school. We went to the same university 2 years apart. She graduated with honors. I graduated. And we had a simple rule in the family. Listen to Val. My sister Valerie is incredible. So, guys, be nice to your sister. You're going to need her. You're going to need her. I promise. It's the same lineup. You're the oldest. Who's number two? Number two? Who's number three? You're twins? Are you guys twins? Okay. All right. This how it was in our outfit. Well, I'm so glad to see you all. Thanks for coming with Mom, okay? You got to take care of your mom. Dads are much harder to raise, but, you know. Before I begin to speak, the reason I spent a little time in the kids, I just want to speak very briefly about the school shooting in Nashville, Tennessee.
Hey, right there, Molly Hemingway. Took him 4 minutes to get there. What do you think of that?
It's amazing. It's cringe-inducing. That was a complete stand-up routine. Not a very good one, but a complete stand-up routine when the country is going through the horrible anguish of this school shooting where young children at this Christian school were killed, faculty and staff at the school were killed. And to be joking about chocolate chip ice cream, it's tonally completely wrong.
And the White House had sent out an alert that, and they broke away. They covered that. Everyone in the country who wanted to see what the president was going to say saw that, Molly. And I think it raises the infirmity question. I'm sure he was briefed. I just can't imagine they would send him out there to do your shtick and then turn to Nashville. I really worry about the guy.
And I think you made a really good point there. They sent out a note to everybody saying that he was going to do a press conference on the shooting in Nashville. Now that's this type of communication between the White House or other prominent places and networks is very important that you're being accurate about this. They'll do it for very big reasons, like we're about to do missile strikes or, you know, there's going to be a press conference about this shooting. Not like every time the president leaves the Oval Office, you just get this kind of notification. And so every network went out of its way to cover this, and this is what happened. And I do think it does speak to some kind of, it could be something else, but it's yet another example of why people are worried about his mental acuity.
Yeah, the infirmity issue is how I refer to it. And I believe he was briefed before he went down. And I believe he was told to strike the tone and go to the prompter on the remarks. And I think he forgot.
And was joking with people. So,
yeah.
The remarks weren't much better. You know, the prepared remarks weren't much better. You know, first he's totally off with the ice cream jokes. And then he goes into, you know, politicization and blaming Republicans. And, you know, that's also not.
Now, I'm going to go there next. Everyone imposes their agenda on every tragedy. And I'm so tired of I don't have anything to add. I want to read the manifesto. I want to know if it's a political crime at all, or I want to be told about that. John Cooper is a good friend of mine. He's a mayor of Nashville. I've known him for 45 years. And so I really have known him for 48 years, actually. He's doing the best he can. He's a Democrat. But I don't want anyone to have an agenda at this point. There is no agenda. We're not going to repeal the Second Amendment. We can put police at schools, and that's what we can do.
I mean, I'm fine with people having discussions about how culture or society or political solutions. I'm fine with that. It just seems kind of the way that we've gotten stuck in a rut where nobody wants to deal with many of the major problems affecting our society. They just retreat to their corners about, you know, the Second Amendment or anti-Second Amendment. And these problems are so much bigger. I mean, we've had guns for a very long time. We have not had this level of violence against children that we're seeing. And so it would be great if people would want to talk about all the things that can go into this. And we don't know. You're right. We have no idea exactly what all went into this. But a society that cared about this would be doing more than just exploiting tragedies for their particular aims.
How long did it take you to figure out that it was a biological woman who sometimes uses male pronouns? Because that was the most frustrating thing. I didn't want to say anything, write anything, and prepare this point until I knew for certain and confirmed. And the Telegraph in Great Britain brings up the trans issue, but none of our major papers. How long did it take you to figure it out?
Well, what was so confusing about it, you know, they say immediately that it was a woman who did it. Everybody starts talking about how women don't typically do mass shootings. And then they identify the woman who did it. So they're talking about her. Then when they say, no, wait, we're seeing reports that this is someone who identifies as male or as transgender. That's when there was confusion about it. But I was very curious to see how the media would respond to this. I do believe in the importance of reflecting biological reality when talking about these things. This is a great example of why. But the media tend to believe that on this issue, you are whatever you identify as. And so they have been having, part of the problem is the media have been all over the place describing this person as a male, describing the young woman as a female, because their own ideology prevents them from just reporting accurately about what's going on.
Yeah, a biological woman who sometimes identifies as a male shot and killed 3 children and 3 teachers at a school yesterday. That's the lead.
Wow.
And it's not hard to say, right?
Yes.
It's just not hard to say. Now, the manifesto is not available. There might be good investigatory reasons for that. Detective Tom is hardcore and calls me often in Oakland, said, hold your fire on that because you have no idea what they're following. I began to think about that. He's right. There might be people named in there. There might be other people involved. But do you think we'll see the manifesto?
I don't know. And I mean, I don't know how I feel about that because so much of these school shootings are about people trying to be famous. You know, you saw that this person even wrote her friend saying, you're going to hear about me on the news later today. You don't want to incentivize future massacres of this nature. But I want to say, I've really been impressed with how the police chief handled everything. He was not defensive. He was sharing information, but not too much. I know people got really upset that the name wasn't released earlier. I think that had to have been for investigatory reasons as well. They're probably trying to, you know, go to every location where they might want to investigate things before media circuses happen. Same with this manifesto or any discussion of motive. And we see so much bad police behavior that I just have to say this police chief and other people that have been involved in interacting with sharing of information have done a remarkably good job.
And Mayor Cooper, as I told you, he's a friend. So I know what he did. They dealt with tornadoes. They dealt with the downtown bomber that blew up and fried their internet. They dealt with COVID. They lost their tax base. They've had a rough 5 years for Coop. And he did a fine job as well. And he struck the right tone with Rachel Maddow. He's not in a rush to politicize this. But eventually, we're going to come down to, and the media is nibbling on. In fact, if we can play Terry Moran for Molly, this is a sly bit of, I like Terry, but sometimes his left wing flies. Cut number 23, please.
All right, that is Police Chief John Drake of Nashville, who is briefing reporters on the deadly grade school shooting in Nashville at the Covenant School there this morning. The police confirming 6 dead, 3 children, 1 8 years old, 2 9 years old, and 3 adults, including Catherine Kuntz, who is the head of the Covenant School. The police chief also said that the shooter has been identified as 28-year-old female Audrey Hale. Said she's a former student of the school and confirmed that Audrey Hale identified herself as a transgender person. State of Tennessee earlier this month passed and the governor signed a bill that banned transgender medical care for minors, as well as a law that prohibited adult entertainment, including male and female impersonators, after a series of drag show controversies in that state.
Molly, can you hold over for a segment? I want to ask you what you think about that, because that it's just reflexive legacy media bias. And I want to talk to you about it when we come back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Molly Hemingway will be here. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt on the day after horror in Nashville. I played, before we went to the break, with Molly Hemingway of Fox News and The Federalist, a clip of Terry Moran on ABC News reporting that ended with references to, I can only interpret it, Molly, as it's the red state's fault. How did you interpret what Terry Moran said?
Yeah, I mean, he did it with a little bit of a wink and a nod, but basically said that Tennessee, having passed legislation and signed legislation into law that protects children from permanent sterilization or the cutting off of healthy body parts or the being pumped full of hormones to block puberty. This was somehow tied to the shooting in a way that suggested he was blaming them for doing that. I understand how difficult it is to cover breaking news, and people make mistakes all the time when they're doing that. But that is probably close to the opposite reaction that a lot of people are having right now about this shooting up of a small Christian school with the murder of an 8-year-old and 2 9-year-olds. But it was very typical. I mean, this is not the only guy who did this. We saw other media reacting this way as well, or pointing out that Nashville is where the Daily Wire is based, and they have been warning about the dangers of radical transgender ideology, again, to suggest that this is to blame. And there was also the radical trans group that called for a day of vengeance this week, including a focus on Tennessee, because they had passed this legislation where they were talking about a day of vengeance against any laws that protect children from some of this dangerous ideology.
Now, because I'm a lawyer, I'm very reluctant to assign proximate or actual cause to anyone doing anything anywhere other than the killer. But I don't see that restraint practiced in the media. Everybody wants a storyline, Molly. Sometimes there aren't storyline. We don't know anything about the killer, really, like other than she's a woman who's 28 years old, as Officer Tom, Detective Tom said. She's 28. She's an adult. There's no formation of character issue here. I don't know how we get out of this cycle of endless assigning of blame by a left-wing media, implication being it's the right-wing's fault. Always, everywhere, and always.
Right. It's the right-winger's fault if you have a crazy lone right-winger who does something. It's also the right-wing's fault if you have an apparent, crazy lone left-winger attacking a group of right-wingers at their Christian school. There's no way to escape that central unifying thesis for all these people. But I think it's because people are trying to fill so much airtime, it leads to rampant speculation. And if you are doing that, I think, though, that rather than say you can't speculate at all or you can't discuss this at all, it's a good opportunity to talk about all the different problems that are facing our society. So the narrowness with which they address this issue, which is blame Republicans, blame guns, even when the facts are close to completely the opposite of that, that is the problem. And it would be better to have a much broader discussion. And
what is the source of that problem? I have my theory, but what does Molly Hemingway think?
Of the problem of
presentation.
I think it's a ton of things that are quite typical for other problems that we have too. Our media are nearly completely on the left, and not just like typical people on the left. They tend to be more radical on the left than a typical Democrat. They go into media for the precise purpose of pushing political agendas, and so they view these horrible incidences as opportunities to advance an agenda rather than report the news or think about the communities that are affected by it. And the hiring, firing, promotion decisions all reinforce this. But it's a real lack of diversity in newsrooms, and it's not going to get better because they haven't been trying to make it better for decades now, but that contribute to all these problems.
I want to add and get your – I also think that people who are secular – I don't know if Terry's secular or a man of faith. I don't know. But they have trouble with good and evil stories. And John Steinbeck, I quoted him earlier from East of Eden, there is one story. And there's only one story, good versus evil. And that story is playing out everywhere in every context, and everyone's enmeshed in it. But they have great trouble with that,
well,
Molly.
You say trouble, but I think everyone believes in evil. And it's, again, the narrowness of the evil with which our media are talking about that is the problem.
Oh, that's well put.
They only view Republicans as evil. They only view their political opponents as evil. But they do. I mean, they quickly locked this into a good versus evil type of story. They just didn't let the facts lead them into where it would normally lay.
Well said. Molly, always a pleasure. MZ Hemingway on Twitter. Watch her on Fox. Read her at The Federalist. Thank you, Molly. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. On the morning after a terrible, terrible murder in Nashville of 6 victims, 3 children, 3 adults, by a 28-year-old woman who had legally purchased weapons. And so the debate will eventually evolve into arms control and guns control. And I'm going to talk with Senator Tom Cotton about that. Good morning, Senator. Welcome. As the father of small children, I'm sure this upsets you as much as it does any parent or grandparent.
Good morning to you. It's a sad day in Nashville, a sad day for our country as we mourn with all of the families who lost loved ones at that school in Nashville and really their entire community there at this heartbreaking tragedy.
Can I ask you this is a technical question that I've seen discussed, and I don't know. It's a question of fact. If the Democrats, when they had their majority in the House and the Senate, had taxed AR-15, the means of raising revenues, $1,000 a gun, and they had put that into the budget, and then they had added it as a reconciliation bill, would that, do you believe, pass the parliamentarians' review?
There's at least an arguable case that it could have, Hugh. I don't know ultimately how our parliamentarians would come down on it, but certainly there's an arguable case. But I think your point is well taken, that the Democrats frequently criticize Republicans for not confiscating weapons from law-abiding citizens, yet when they have political power, as they did for the past 2 years, they don't take action do so themselves, in part because they realize that not only would it not solve the problems we have with mass murder in this country, it also would be infringement on the rights of law-abiding citizens.
But it is at least possible that that would be upheld. And was any effort made to do that when they had the reconciliation power, which is the power to bypass the 60-vote veto?
No, not to my knowledge, Hugh. Perhaps they discussed it internally and dropped it, but not to my knowledge.
Did they do anything on the Dreamers, another favorite of the left to bring up repeatedly? We've had a terrible tragedy in Juarez this morning. 37 people are dead at a refugee and immigrant center in Mexico, not in the United States, and many more are believed to be in danger of losing their life because of crowd conditions, whatever. Did they bring up the Dreamers? I don't mean whatever and dismissive. I just mean I don't know the facts.
No serious effort on my part. On my knowledge, Hugh, of course, there's always legislation introduced, but a serious effort would be bringing it up in committee, to try to pass it out in committee, and then Chuck Schumer bringing it to the floor. That was certainly not done, even though you probably could have gotten 60 votes or more. I mean, I've supported legislation in the past in the Trump era that the president asked me to help draft and support, that would have given some kind of regularized status to adults who were brought here illegally when they were minors, but in return for things that would stop the problem in the long term, like building the wall and changing our asylum laws so the system can't be gamed and stopping chain migration. There was no serious effort to try to forge that kind of compromise during the last 2 years for the Democrats.
So, Senator, you have been a legislator for 10 years on Capitol Hill. Is all seriousness gone from the body on the left? I mean, did they ever do anything with serious, purposeful intent to reach the to reach the center and pass something?
Well, Hugh, I think in my 10 years, I've seen the steady drift leftward of the Democratic Party on really radicalized issues. You know, things today, or I'm sorry, Barack Obama, much less Bill Clinton, took positions when they were running for president or even when they were president that they would have them excommunicated from the Democratic Party. And as they drift further and further to the left and further away from the mainstream of America, then they begin to focus more and more on what I would say are tiny, trivial issues that don't address the urgent and pressing challenges of our day, such as tackling inflation or controlling crime or standing up to a aggressive Russia and China and Iran.
And are they apologetic about that? I just don't think people understand the collapse of seriousness in the Democrats.
I've not heard any apologize to me, Hugh. I'm not sure how they feel in their private moments. Normally, the Democrats in the Congress are pretty committed to carrying Joe Biden's water.
Now, the president had a very bad moment yesterday when all the networks were informed he would address the shooting in Nashville, and they all carried it live, and he did 4 minutes of stand-up comedy before he turned to it. And I was talking about it with Molly Hemingway. It just strikes me that he is losing the ability to communicate with the American people, not because he has dementia. I just think he's old. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, it keeps getting worse. Hugh. I mean, it's worse than it was a year ago when he went to Poland and extemporized that the United States should see regime change in Russia. I said at the time, you should just stop speaking extemporaneously and off the cuff in public. He hasn't taken that advice yet, but he has. I think the White House has substantially reduced the amount of time that he's speaking extemporaneously or off the cuff in public. And that embarrassing moment that we all witnessed yesterday is probably a reason why. And I'll just put it simply, Joe Biden is too old to be president. And a vote for Joe Biden is a vote for Kamala Harris.
I think you're right. And I hope people understand that. Now, if I can switch to one more technical thing about the Senate, it's a very small group of people. It's a club. And two of your members of your club are infirm as well, John Fetterman and Dianne Feinstein. They're not going to work. What does that do to the work of the Senate?
Well, first off, Hugh, there's obviously a big difference between being the commander in chief and being one of 100 senators.
Correct.
You know, you don't have in the Senate. You're not on the potential, urgent action to defend our nation. So I wish Senators Fetterman and Senators Feinstein a full and complete recovery. We never wish ill on anyone, even political adversaries and rivals. But to have two Democrats down, of course, makes it, in effect, evenly split Senate once again, and it complicates the abilities of the Democrats to move their most controversial nominees across the Senate floor. For instance, two of them have gone down in the last month. A radical nominated chair of the Federal Communications Commission and an unqualified nominee to lead the Federal Aviation Administration. I do suspect, based on the reports I've heard, that Senator Fetterman and Senator Feinstein will recover and be back at work eventually. But there is a big difference between being one of 100 senators and being the president of the United States. We've had cases in the past like Tim Johnson from South Dakota or Mark Kirk from Illinois who suffered strokes and were absent for a long time. And of course, that deprived their party of that vote on the floor. Their offices kept serving their states. But that's obviously not a situation that would be tenable if you had a president who suffered from that kind of condition.
Well, I remember when Strom Thurmond was making his record bid to be the oldest senator ever, and he was led around by staff and he voted, but he was there. I'm not trying to connect Joe Biden's performance yesterday with these senators. I just want, is anything getting done? Are they nominating and are they approving any judges?
So actually Senator Feinstein's absence from the Judiciary Committee has stalled all but the most bipartisan nominees, because the Democrats have to have all senators on the committee in person present voting yes to get the nominee on that committee, unless Republicans give them votes in committee. So I think, typically we have one session a week on the Judiciary Committee when we vote out nominees. I think it's been 2 or 3 weeks now since we've done that. So they're starting to run out of judges on the floor to confirm. They're also getting to a point where the president's going to have to start compromising with senators in states like Arkansas with two Republicans if he wants to continue to confirm district court nominees.
Have they put forward any kind of conversation with you? Normally in California, that process has been for years when a Republican is in, we get one, they get one. Is that what they're doing with Arkansas?
We've had preliminary discussions, Hugh. I mean, we're not obviously the size of California, so there are not nearly as many vacancies. But I think that the White House understands that when you're talking about Republican states, two Republican senators like Arkansas or Louisiana, Tennessee, Mississippi, and so forth, they're going to have to compromise and provide a list of nominees that are acceptable to the two Republican senators from those states. And, we're not looking for partisan ideologues. I never look for partisan ideologues on the court. Looking for jurists who will enforce the law as it's written and uphold the Constitution as it was originally understood.
During my 30 years of practice, I appeared in front of a number of judges. Some of them were nuts and some of them were great, and it never depended upon party affiliation. Never. I knew what their ideology was, but you can find competent trial judges everywhere.
Yeah, and a lot of it is a matter of competence and character and integrity. Trial judges are not setting precedent that affects numerous states like the courts of appeals do, and certainly the Supreme Court. But they have vast discretion on evidentiary rulings or preliminary motions that are nearly unreviewable. And you certainly want to make sure that you get men and women of character and discernment and integrity. Having worked for an appellate judge, I remember an old joke that I heard among some of the judges on the Fifth Circuit. What's the difference between God and a United States district judge? And the answer is, God doesn't think he's a United States district judge.
That last question for you, Senator. I'm going to teach today the Lochner era, Lochner to West Coast Hotel. And that is the rise of laissez-faire through the repeal of laissez-faire by the court, all judge-made. I'm going to begin by talking about the Second Amendment. If someone brought forth an amendment to repeal the Second Amendment, seeking the 2/3 vote in the House and the Senate necessary to send it to the states for 3/4 vote, how many senators do you think would vote for that?
Not many, Hugh. Maybe, obviously, no Republicans. And you might get half of the Democratic caucus to vote for it. I don't know, maybe 2/3.
And so every conversation about gun control has got to begin with the Second Amendment, because it's not going anywhere, right? When I hear people say we've got to do something, they got to understand if they mean confiscating guns, they've got to start with the Second Amendment, and they never do.
Yeah, they start with the Second Amendment, and they have to accept the precedent on the Second Amendment. You know, the Democrats have a habit in Supreme Court hearings of always celebrating the precedents they like, as so-called super precedents.
Yes.
They could never possibly repeal, no matter how bad they were decided and how badly they had divided our society and wrenched the law out of recognition, as Roe v. Wade had. But they never want to defend precedents they don't like Citizens United or the recent Second Amendment cases going back 15 years that make plain that the Second Amendment means exactly what it says, that every American has an individual right to own firearms and carry them and use them to defend himself and his or her family.
And that's Heller and that's McDonald, and they are good law. And unless and until someone steps up and says we've got to change that, it will not work. Senator Cotton, next week we'll talk about court packing, because Israel's issue, but not this week. Thank you for joining me. Don't go anywhere, America.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.